Okay, I think we're about to get ready if everybody's back from lunch. So welcome to the second immunotherapy panel. Immunotherapy panel, the topic that's so hot that we need to have two sessions and a luncheon in between it. So the old news is that immuno-oncology has become the hottest space in cancer. Newer news, but not so new, is that gene and cell therapies are important components of the cancer immunotherapy toolkit. And today we're going to specifically be talking about adoptive T-cell therapies, mostly about the T-cell receptors, the chimeric antigen receptors. And unfortunately, Cashin Yee couldn't make it today, but we'll also touch on other things like cytotoxic T-cells and TILs. Okay, so 25 years later, after the first publications on genetic redirection of T-cells, we've shown robust clinical activity. And the reason why I say it's newer news is that, it's really in the last 2 years where it's really gained significant attention and investment, despite having very striking clinical responses and proof of concept prior to that and even published in peer-reviewed publications. But what really triggered it was really, in 2013 when numerous groups were reporting significant clinical responses, mostly in ALL, but also in CLL and other B-cell malignancies with CD19-targeted CAR T-cells. So in the past year, we've seen tremendous investment in space, both from, deals with large pharmaceutical companies as well as VC investment and IPOs in the space. So it's become a very hot and competitive space just within the last couple years. And really, this year is really kind of driven, or 2014 has really driven much of the momentum in the space. So when you look at the CAR T pipeline, we have numerous clinical trials going on now from multiple biotech and pharma companies, mostly in collaboration with academic investigators. And even the analysts are now starting to cover the space. So, again, there's only a couple projections around CAR T products. So here what I did is I took any T-cell redirecting therapies that I could see in the databases where there was analyst coverage, and it's showing significant growth of the CAR T space beyond what is being achieved with the bispecific antibodies, and also much of it is really indication dependent. So diffuse large B cell is looked at it to be a much larger opportunity than ALL. But anyway, this is very, very new and it's very speculative at this point, so it'll be interesting to see how this plays out and when we think about how different technologies and therapies will compete, given the changing standard of care in all these B-cell malignancies. Okay, so it's not just CAR Ts, TCRs, TILs, other donor-derived T-cells and cytotoxic T-cells have also drawn significant investment, and there's been a very diverse, a large diversification of different immunotherapy approaches that are cellular or genetic based. However, we're very early yet. We can think of this as being really in the early years of this technology, even though it's been in development for 25 years. It's really now that we're, understanding and we've established proof of concept and we know the issues that we need to address, or many of the issues that need to be addressed yet, to both improve efficacy as well as, address safety issues and other things related to the business model and how you would actually deliver it to the market. We've had a few generations now that we're working on in improvements of CARs. I'm not going to go into detail. I'm sure that the panel will speak much more intelligently about that. But there are at least seven features that are needed to be put together to optimize CAR T cells or adoptive T cell therapies. Mainly, you need to have, a way to induce specificity for a target, either through the TCR or the CAR. You need to have something where you can enhance and amplify the activity, components that preserve T cell survival and can be used for T cell proliferation, you know, as well as trafficking and things that deal with microenvironment, particularly when we get out of acute lymphoblastic leukemia and start to think about more bulky tumors. You know, there are issues that need to be encountered and are being encountered, and features that could be improved with the current CAR T cells. And then last but not least, there's some significant safety issues that are being addressed both through improvements in protocols but also by incorporating features such as suicide switches and things like that into the T cells themselves. So that said, so there's been, you know, significant investment in space, and many of the large biopharmaceutical companies are taking stakes beyond, you know, checkpoint inhibitors, antibodies, small molecules, and vaccines. But there's also been significant investment and increasing investment into other gene and cell-based approaches like oncolytic viruses and adoptive T-cell therapies. And so we just look back over the last 2 years, these deals, there's real money going to this space after, you know, many years of not attracting any investment, and there are, you know, big dollars going after making this these technologies work, both through partnerships, IPOs. You know, investors seem to be very open and believe that, you know, the time is now to move these technologies forward. And through, you know, venture financing. So that said, so that's a quick, you know, overview of the space and what's going on. So I'd like to introduce the panel and hand it off to each of my panelists to give a self-introduction and to share a little bit about what they're doing and what sort of, you know, opportunities and issues that they see moving forward in space. So first, I'd like to introduce Rainier Brenchin from Sloan Kettering and Juno.
Thanks for inviting me to the panel here. I'm Rainier Brenchins. I work at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. I am a scientific co-founder of Juno Therapeutics, just for full disclosure. I started working on CAR T-cell therapy now 17 years ago in relative obscurity, being relegated to the back of the poster sessions on the last day at ASH, away from the beer and the pretzels. And over the years, we developed the first CAR T cell trials with retroviral vectors to target CD19. We initially started treatment or therapeutic phase one trials in relapsed CLL, which probably in hindsight was not the ideal disease to target, and followed that up with clinical trials in ALL, which we've now expanded to clinical trials in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, B-cell non-Hodgkin's lymphoma as well, all of which are CD19 targeted. I am in charge of the Cellular Therapeutics Center at Sloan Kettering that runs the CAR T-cell program there. And I have a laboratory at Sloan Kettering where we're working on next-generation CAR T-cells, which will probably come up in the discussion.
My name is Dolores Schendel. I'm also one of these obscure academicians who worked for 20 years trying to develop T-cell receptor engineering for patient lymphocytes. And again, my work has concentrated on trying to develop technologies that allow us to broaden the different types of molecules that we can target for T-cell receptor specificities. If you followed the CAR-19 T-cells, then you know there's one antibody specificity that's being used in a number of different indications and is captured by a number of different companies. The T-cell receptor can be seen as a second type of molecule to dock the patient's effector T-cells onto their tumor cells. And we have the capacity using the native T-cell receptor to address a number of additional target antigens. And I've just outlined on this one slide for you the types of molecules that have actually been demonstrated to be targets of T cells that have had in individual cases or in some clinical settings, some have demonstrated some clinical efficacy. We really learned that T cells can be curative for leukemias in the setting of bone marrow transplantation, and those T cells recognize minor histocompatibility antigens, genetic differences between the donor and the recipient, and pieces of those proteins are presented on the surface of the patient's leukemia cells and recognized by the donor lymphocytes. A number of early T-cell receptor trials concentrated on differentiation antigens and some of the melanoma antigens that were studied by the group of Steve Rosenberg at the NCI showed that if you had receptors with higher affinity, you could achieve greater clinical efficacy, but that was also associated with toxicity, and I think that's one of the issues that the panel will probably discuss here today. Everybody hopes you could find some universal tumor antigens that could be used for every type of cancer and in every type of patient. I think that issue is still open. The true problem that we face is the right specificity to find antigens that are really expressed in the tumor cells and not present on normal tissue, and I think those universal tumor-associated antigens are not likely to fulfill that criteria. A better source of antigens are the cancer testis antigens that show really only limited expression in adult tissues, but are often highly overexpressed in tumor cells. And that's one category of antigens that perhaps can give us more reagents that can be used in multiple patients, but may have the right safety profile when we utilize high-affinity receptors. Virus-specific antigens for those cancers that are really associated with a viral etiology are, of course, again, very optimal targets because they will give the measure of specificity that one seeks. And we talked earlier today about neoantigens, neoepitopes, so even patient-individualized specific peptides that can be presented from intracellular proteins, mutated proteins, presented by the patient's own MHCs and become potential targets for T-cell receptors. But there are even some mutated epitopes, such as fusion proteins like BCR-ABL or KRAS mutations that are shared by multiple patients and multiple tumors. And those types of epitopes also would deliver the desired specificity. So what we want in the end is to be able to have a library of T-cell receptors and that from this set of on-the-shelf reagents, one could find the right matched MHC molecule and epitope and match that to the patient for a therapeutic treatment. Now, I've shown on this slide the T cells expressing two receptors. They're not mixed, so I think we really have accomplished that step in the field that one can get with some minor engineering. One can get proper pairing of the transgenic receptor, but of course, the real issue is to replace the receptor, to not have the endogenous T cell receptor expressed at all, and I think the field is moving rapidly to deal with that issue. The other thing is, do we really have to use the patient's own T cells to create the therapeutic? And there are a lot of initiatives in a number of groups, both academic and in the commercial setting, trying to solve that riddle. So maybe the on-the-shelf reagents will not be the T cell receptors themselves in the form of viral vectors or DNA vectors, but that they will be ready-made T cells that are on the shelf. And those, I think, are upcoming developments that we can expect to see in the field.
Tom?
Good afternoon. I'm Tom Farrell. I'm a president and CEO of Belicon Pharmaceuticals. We are a cellular immunotherapy company based in Houston, Texas. And I guess I'd like to start out with a somewhat obvious observation, which is that T cells are not drug-like. So you give T cells to a patient. The idea is that those cells then proliferate. So unlike a drug, which will be eliminated over time, T cells tend to, if they're going to have any effect, they're proliferating, they're expanding. This creates three principal challenges. One is safety. So those T cells continue to proliferate and expand. They have the potential to cause toxicity to the patient. The other is efficacy, which is where they don't expand at all. You give them to the patient, and you look a week later and the cells are gone. And then the third, which really relates to both, is one of consistency. So you want to get a T cell product over the finish line. If you want a licensed product, you have to find a way to make a product that's going to be consistent from patient to patient, that's going to have a consistent safety and efficacy profile. So with that as the background, we have developed a platform technology. It's called chemical induction of dimerization. And essentially, it's a way to co-opt a natural signaling pathway inside a cell and put it under the control of a small molecule activator. So we put a molecular switch inside a cell. We administer the cell to the patient, and then depending on what happens and what it is that we need to do, we then administer a small molecule drug that then turns that switch on. So today, all of our products incorporate this technology. We have two specific switches. One is a safety switch. It essentially is based on an inducible form of caspase 9, which is a key member of the apoptosome. When you activate caspase 9, the cell is obligated to undergo apoptosis. So this is a way to eliminate or to dial back T cells that are causing toxicity. Could be graft versus host disease in the setting of transplantation. Could be cytokine release syndrome with a CD19 CAR. Could be an on-target off-organ toxicity, such as has been seen with solid tumor-targeted CARs, where the antigen is not as exquisite as CD19. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, if we look at efficacy, as I indicated, often the experience with solid tumors is that you don't have the right environment for those T cells to proliferate. So what we're looking at there is how do we appropriately activate the T cell so that it will indeed proliferate, that it will gain a foothold in the patient, and it will have an opportunity to have a therapeutic effect. So by putting controls, we either have a safety switch or we have an activation switch. By incorporating one or other of those, we can get to a more consistent product. So with that as our platform technology, we have three products in development, two are in the clinic. One, as I indicated, is a product for transplantation, where we're able to give back T cells that help engraftment, immune reconstitution, graft versus leukemia effect in the transplant setting, which is, of course, the if you like, the grandfather of cellular immunotherapy. But in the event that those T cells cause graft versus host disease, we can eliminate or dial back the cells and resolve the toxicity. Second product is a dendritic cell vaccine. This contains our activation switch. It is in a phase one trial in the U.S. Then we have three CAR T-cell or TCR product candidates that are moving towards the clinic. They're targeting PRAME, CD19, and PSCA. And these incorporate either our cell elimination switch or our activation switch. In the future, we have some very exciting work that's going on in the lab where we're looking at putting two switches into the same cell so that you can either activate or eliminate the cells depending on what the need is. So today, two products in the clinic. By sometime in 2016, we'll have potentially up to five clinical stage products. Thanks.
Thanks. Gary?
Thanks. I'm really happy to be here as part of this panel. And looking around the room, actually, there's a few familiar, friendly faces. Lauren Avery, who hired me into fellowship at Sloan Kettering many years ago, who's now at Roche. Rainier, who we sat next to one another. His lab was next to the fellows room at Sloan Kettering. I think I saw Richard Gaynor here from Lilly as well. So I think in this emerging field, we really are learning from one another, from one another's experiences. Is that Eric Rowinsky? Okay, Eric Rowinsky, my big mentor in industry. So the big point that I wanted to make, at least initially, was that from the pharmaceutical perspective, there's a lot of investment in this field in general, right? So Novartis, for example, spun out a cell and gene therapies unit actually less than a year ago. Last time we were here, we were part of oncology. We are now part of the cell and gene therapies unit, which is run by Oz. Oz, I had lunch with him today, says that we're going to have up to 500 people in this unit by the end of the year. There's a lot of investment, interest, sort of excitement around the space, largely because of the amazing response rates that we've seen through UPenn, through Sloan Kettering, through NCI, et cetera, especially the hematologic malignancies, and largely also because we're trailblazing, we're creating something new, we're learning how to approach benefit risk in a different way. The benefit in some cases is so high with 90, 95% complete response rates in refractory disease, but then you start reaching limits of toxicity, so you have to actually dial back a bit. So there are some big clinical challenges along those lines. There are regulatory challenges from the pharma and biotech perspective. For example, what does orphan designation mean in the CAR space? Is it based on construct? Is it based on other things? No one knows this, even at the FDA, for example. So these are lessons that we are learning together as clinicians, as industry folks, as regulators, as reimbursement personnel as well. Manufacturing is interesting. I think this is going to be the big challenge for many pharmaceutical and biotechs coming up with this technology, the CAR technology. First of all, how do you create a GMP quality space that's that also can host multiple indications and possibly multiple CARTs, right? And then also when you get to larger disease areas such as lymphoma, where you can have thousands of patients treated per year, how do you really scale up? How do you make this less labor intensive and a little bit more automated? So the whole process from patient to patient, including reimbursement, is streamlined. So it's an exciting field, and I'm happy to be part of the panel to discuss.
So thanks, Gaurav. So you already sort of answered the first question that I had was, what has really changed in, the last 2 years that really stimulated investment into the space? I think, Rainier, you didn't have to do the disclosure about Juno. Tom, I think you were still pre-IPO. Everybody was still pre-IPO then. So now what has changed? I mean, now that you have the investment and, you're at the front of the oncology field, what do you do different? What are you doing now?
Well, this is the first iteration. The CD19 second generation CAR is the one that has garnered a lot of attention. It's in part because, quite uniquely, three different types of second generation CARs targeting the same antigen have all had eerily similar response rates, 72 to 90% complete remissions in B-cell ALL in the relapse setting. It's probably not an exaggeration to say it's one of the biggest advances in ALL made in years, along with the BiTE antibody as well. So I think that was a proof of principle, and I think that the real question moving forward is, have we developed a new therapy for B-cell ALL, or is this just the tip of the iceberg? And I think everyone sitting up here is banking on that cell therapy, especially with T-cells, is now in its infancy. And so what I would see is there's two areas where this technology will move forward in an academic setting. And the first is to generate T cells that can meet some of the qualifications that were mentioned previously by Dolores and by Tom, which is, can you make the cells persist long enough? Can you make the cells adapt to the microenvironment? Can you make these cells function in solid tumors as opposed to just in one particular type of hematologic malignancy? And as a corollary to that, the second area where I think this technology is going academically, at least, and probably also industrially, is the identification of suitable targets. Again, CD19, there's a reason why three centers, if not more centers, were working on CD19. It's because it is a very attractive target. It's expressed on normal B cells. You can live without your normal B cells, so on-target off-tumor toxicity can be predictably relatively manageable. Beyond 19, however, there's a steep drop-off as to what are attractive targets, and that is in part because the tumors don't provide us with many unique target antigens to go after, and also in part because when you shift over to solid tumors, the heterogeneity is remarkable. And so targeting a single antigen is likely to be insufficient unless the adoptive-cell approach is allows to target multiple antigens or to recruit the endogenous immune system to help in the response. So I think that that's where things are going, at least on an academic or scientific level.
Mm-hmm. Anybody, Dolores, you want to add anything to that with the TCRs?
Well, I think the issues are the same. I think we have many more targets that are potentially amenable to for the development of therapeutic agents with the intracellular protein world of tumor cells. But heterogeneity will remain an issue, and particularly with single agents. I think there's discussion in the CAR field to put two CARs on the effector cell populations. You can also imagine to do that with T-cell receptors as well. But finding the right affinity of those receptors that they can effectively recognize tumor cells while not having any reaction on normal tissues is a very probably a very fine line of balance. And there's a lot of work to identify those appropriate T-cell receptors that can be beneficial therapeutic agents.
So Tom, you want to add? So if you know, CD19 is a ideal target, and you know it seems like that there's still features or things that we need to do with the current CAR technology. What are you guys doing, and how do you see that evolving? Before we talk about new targets.
Sure. And maybe I guess I'd like to partially answer the previous question, too,
yep,
in terms
certainly.
Of what we see. I mean, clearly, as has been alluded to, this field was significantly underfunded until very recently. So, and really until a year ago, really, there was very little published data. It was mostly anecdotal. There was a few patients here and there. Is that a fair characterization?
About 2011, I think, it with the publication of the 3 CLL patients
right.
was probably kind
but
of.
Then it was
but
last
but
year
but then
where
it
there
stopped
was.
And then the ALL stuff came out.
And then there was enough data to see what are the response rates, what is the rate of morbidity or perhaps even mortality. And I think that's something that's going to continue to. I think we're excited about the next couple of years, you know, getting data out of products that are targeting antigens other than CD19. Because clearly the big question still is, are CAR T-cells or TCRs or TILs going to be effective outside of CD19? And I think having more data to look at will help answer that question. From our standpoint, in order to push the envelope outside of CD19, I think what we see already with CD19 is you're at the limit of the therapeutic window where clearly the ability to take care of patients that are experiencing cytokine release syndrome is continuing to evolve. But you do have a significant percentage of patients that are in the ICU, which is never a good thing. And there's some level of mortality, or there would appear to be. Whether that can be completely dealt with, I think, remains to be seen. But if you now think about targeting an antigen that is less exquisite, as Rainier's indicated, than CD19, or where you need a more potent construct, an armored car, for example, where you're adding additional cytokines to the mix, then you're pushing the potency and you need to do something to manage the toxicity. And we are seeing, and I guess we like to think that we were kind of the siren call here, that you need safety built into these next generation of products. There needs to be a way to rescue a patient in a dire situation or in a life-threatening situation, or indeed to manage the expansion of the cells. So you're not terminating therapy, you're just dialing it back. And that's very much what we're focused on. And so the products that we're looking to move into the clinic are allowing us to push the envelope in terms of potency while having that insurance policy that potentially gives the patient and their physician some comfort that if they get into trouble, there's something that can be done about it.
Gareth, do you want
to? Yeah, I agree with everything that's been said. I think the one additional major change from last year is that various institutions started experiencing the real toxicities of this therapy. That this is difficult to administer. It really requires, just speaking of CARs for the moment, requires at times extensive ICU stays. Some patients don't make it. I think everyone has reported out on these on certain death cases by now. And our challenge is how to learn from those cases. Was the dose range too high? Was the disease burden too high? Is there a better methodology to give anti-IL-6 receptor therapy, et cetera? So there are there's a path here that we haven't figured out. And I believe that the field has become a little bit more self-conscious and perhaps even a little bit more humble in the last, because in the initial excitement was so great. And I think, and well-deserved, obviously, these are, I think as Rainier said, these are unprecedented response rates in ALL, probably in the history of ALL, perhaps, except, the upfront therapy. And so we've all learned that we need to learn more about this. I think that's changed. That's been a big change. And also, how do you apply this across indications? Is it one process per indication, across all indications that are CD19, or can you optimize the process for ALL versus lymphoma versus CLL? So these are the things that we are learning now as well. So I would say those are the two big changes.
Yes. So maybe we can follow up a little bit more on the safety. So is it something that, we have changed protocols and are addressing procedurally, or is it something where we do need to put in safety switches and, that is going to be a central component of CAR-Ts in the future?
Yeah, so I would defer to Tom regarding probably the world expert on safety switches there, so I'll defer to him.
Well, obviously they're essential.
Yeah, of course they are. So from an operational and logistics viewpoint and patient management viewpoint, and ASH and ASCO, the various companies have presented different toxicity management guidelines, different cytokines that are released in when CRS is flagrant. And I think we're coming to some sort of consensus about how to best manage this toxicity. One thing, for example, that could be done early is the administration of tocilizumab. And the timing of that with steroids is sort of a moving target so far. So we are collaborating on figuring out safety management from a clinical management practice viewpoint. Also, in patient selection, can we perhaps select patients with acceptable tumor burden that's not too high? And also, as I had said originally, can we dose titrate? Can we go back to the drawing board in some cases and dose titrate the administration of the therapy so that we don't go over a certain target?
Can I just make a comment here? Because, there has been a lot made about toxicity, and rightly so. And it's absolutely true that many of these patients do warrant observation in the ICU. And I must say that it was one of the gratifying things for me being in charge of cell therapy at cellular therapeutics at Sloan Kettering is that we put together a very sound team, and as long as everybody's on the same page of the playbook, it becomes less daunting. The first time it happened, believe me, it was daunting. Nowadays, it's become somewhat routine, and at times I'm not even aware of when patients are moved to the ICU because the care is just quite seamless. The other thing that I think should be taken into account when we talk about safety is that this, in the adult setting, relapsed B-cell ALL, these are heavily pretreated patients, and these are patients that are susceptible to dying from any further salvage chemotherapies whatsoever. And so, there is toxicity. Yes, it's manageable toxicity, certainly in our hands. We're very comfortable with it, and we may be able to get a better grasp of it and algorithms to deal with cytokine release. Mm-hmm. But what I would say is that at least, the deaths that I'm aware of on study are not necessarily unexpected deaths in this patient population. We seem to forget that we treat patients up to 70-plus years old with these CAR T-cell therapies. To get them through that is a testament to our clinicians. The fact that a patient may succumb to an understandable opportunistic infection or develop cardiac arrhythmias in the context of underlying heart disease. These are all aspects of managing ALL. And although the CAR T-cell therapies are clearly in the spotlight and being closely monitored, any other trial, adult B-cell ALL trial that has deaths on study is absolutely unremarkable. It's tragic, obviously, mm-hmm. but it's unremarkable to patients and to physicians in the field of leukemia because it is indeed as sick a population as you can possibly have to deal with.
That's a great point.
And so if you move out of that setting into, less advanced patient populations, other malignancies, I mean, is it now more of a concern that we're worried about safety than, in the current, first-in-man experiments that, have been ongoing?
I think that the first time you infuse a patient with a new TCR, a new CAR for a new target, it's a very anxiety-ridden process. There are not suitable preclinical animal models that can accurately predict what the toxicity is going to be. So it is dependent on the investigators to, A, do as best a job as they can to target appropriate antigens, B, to include as much safety as is possible with suicide vectors or with elimination constructs, so that's there, and to start at a suitably and humble, low enough dose so that you can see what may or may not happen. Mm-hmm. It's hard to predict. So there's two types of toxicity. There's the toxicity of when the cells hit the target, they hit it well, and they're going crazy. And these patients look like they developed the worst flu imaginable because that's exactly what's happening. It's an immune response. It's the same as if the immune system were to recognize a flu virus, et cetera. The last thing you may want to hear is that a CAR T cell was extremely well tolerated. I mean, that's probably a bad sign because that's the nature of what we're doing here. Can we manage the side effects? Of course we can. We give high-dose chemotherapies. We get patients through transplants all the time. It's simply learning what the algorithms are to minimize the toxicity and optimize the anti-tumor efficacy. So there's that side of it. To be truthful, once the first patient that we had that developed frank cytokine release syndrome, once that patient was stable, we were overjoyed because we knew that something was happening. And when we did a sternal aspirate, we went, that 10 days earlier had 80% blast, now had zero blast. That's great. The other that toxicity may be manageable. You need to keep it into account. The other toxicity is the on-target, off-tumor toxicity, and that's extremely difficult to predict. And I've said this before to people in the lab and to our clinicians, you have to test that in the human model. It doesn't matter if there's a mouse analog and the mice tolerate a lot of things a lot better than a 70-year-old with relapsed B-cell ALL. So safety will always be a concern, but you will always have to do that first, second, third patient where you're going to be up at night worried that what may happen because it's unforeseen. And you can only do what you can do, which is minimize the dose, have safety measures in place, and make sure that your ICU knows how to deal with these types of issues. And I think we're very well suited for that. I think everyone here and all the clinical trial centers that are being employed are properly instructed on managing those unforeseen toxicities.
Yes, and I think also we can maybe anticipate that there will be some major technological strides that will come in the future. They're not in place yet, mm-hmm. but that we'll have means to maybe turn on the expression mm-hmm. of our receptor, either the CAR or the T-cell receptor, for a transient period of time. If there's an overt toxicity, turn it off, be able to grade it in timing, for expression, or may have the possibility to use mechanisms such as transient in vitro transcribed RNA expression of a T-cell receptor for the first in man to get a first view of its potential toxicity when one sees with giving graded numbers of cells over an extended period of time that there is an acceptable, there's no unexpected toxicity, that then one could move to using such candidates then in a stable, permanent manner of expression. So I think we'll develop tools and technologies that will help us to partially mitigate some of this, but I agree totally that, We'll learn this with the first-in-man experiences with each of these receptors. And I think even There's an additional problem with the T-cell receptor-based therapy that you don't face with the CAR therapy, and that is a T-cell receptor is negatively selected against a patient's own MHC molecules, but once we start using off-the-shelf reagents, that process doesn't match anymore to all the additional MHC molecules that any patient has. So there will be surprises that will vary from patient to patient, and it's going to require experience in more than a few patients, and there still might be down the line in the 100th patient a mismatch, a cross-recognition that we will never predict with the first 99 just because of the power of these receptors that we need to have clinical efficacy and that occasional cross-recognition. Mm-hmm. That's why, again, the chance to get rid of them fast.
Right, right. I mean, so I think Rainier was sort of focusing on perhaps the need for some kind of safety technology in a product from a development standpoint when you first go into patients. Do you need to have something because you don't know what's going to happen in that patient? So there's a famous example at NCI where a patient treated with a third-generation CAR targeting HER2 had low level of expression of HER2 in the lungs and died about 5 days later. That was a very large dose of cells. It was a third very potent construct. But if I guess the question is, okay, so let's say you have a novel solid tumor-targeted CAR, you go into the clinic, you treat the first patient, and everything's good. You treat the second patient, everything is good. Third patient, you have a toxicity. How does that play out? I mean, are you looking for kind of a go-no-go type of indication where you say if, you know, more than X percent of patients or experience a serious life-threatening toxicity, then we don't have a product? Or do you, if the incidence of that toxicity is below a certain threshold, do you then have a viable product, but you need the insurance policy there to ensure that those patients that do experience toxicity can, in fact, be rescued?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what about on the efficacy? So if we stay on CD19 for another moment, you know, we've seen striking responses in ALL, durable responses. We've seen less compelling responses in CLL, and I think it's still a little early for DLBCL and other NHLs to read out. So it's the same target, you know, and, you know, we're targeting targets that are, you know, across all the affected cells. So why do we see such different responses in, you know, this set of related disorders?
Anybody?
I think there's probably a multitude of things that are going on. And believe me, we've discussed at length in our lab meetings and what the possibilities are. One is tumor microenvironment. The amount or number of mechanisms that tumors can use, and this is especially true in solid tumors, but maybe similarly true in CLL, for example, includes PD-L1 expression, cytokine expressions, tumor-associated macrophages, myeloid-derived suppressor cells, IDO. There's a whole list of ways that a tumor can avert or avoid the recognition by the immune system. And so that harkens back to the idea that you know, what we have right now as far as CAR therapy goes is maybe a Model A Ford, and what we need is something a little bit more robust like a Ferrari. And that may be, again, this concept of armored cars where the T-cell can go into that microenvironment, modulate that microenvironment and switch switch that microenvironment in favor of a pro-inflammatory response. Now, all of that has increased safety concerns as well. I mean, the fact that we have cytokine release syndrome, and the next thing we're developing is a T cell that makes even more cytokine has a certain air of irony to it. The other issue is location. CLL tends to be a lymph node disease as well as a marrow disease, while ALL is predominantly a marrow disease, and so there may be something more favorable about the marrow for the T cells that may be not necessarily present in the lymph nodes. And then there's underlying pathology in the T cells alone. CLL patients have dysfunctional T cells, it's known, and it's possible that that dysfunction carries over to the CAR-modified cells that we've utilized to treat these patients. And, you know, if we can narrow it down to any one of those three, I'm sure even more options can be brought up, but it's very clear that despite initial promise in CLL, subsequent data does not show that CLL is right now an ideal target for this therapy.
Mm-hmm. Right. So just to add to what Rainier is saying, and sort of also to put a different perspective, when you compare this therapy across the oncology portfolio that we're looking at. So yes, if you put ALL side by side with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma with CLL, I mean, ALL is you know, we're obviously a different level of responsiveness. However, even within the lymphoma space and within the CLL space, if you look across the institutions that are studying this, we're still getting 40, 50, 60% response rates, in many cases, mostly complete response rates with some institutions, some of them 4 years or longer. So it's still remarkable in a highly refractory patient population that we're getting these sorts of results. It's just that when you compare it side by side with ALL, it's not so compelling. That said, can we bring the other tumor types up to the same level as ALL over time and manage toxicity appropriately? I think that remains to be seen. And again, that's evolved in the thinking around that has evolved quite a bit in the last year, which is a change from last year. And also to go back to your question about what happens when you bring it into earlier lines of therapy, you know, with regard to safety issues, like traditional drug development, we start later in the landscape, in the sequencing, and we move things forward. We try to learn what, you know, later stages of therapy, and we bring those learnings around about safety earlier. In this space, though, some constructs are better suited as consolidation therapy. For example, there's a lymphoma protocol at Sloan Kettering, which is a consolidation protocol. So there you are going early, and some of the learnings are even in the earlier line settings. So it's a little bit of a complex answer. You can't just say that you take your later lines of therapy and bring them forward and you improve your safety. It's a little bit of back and forth there.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay. Just to follow up on the efficacy side, though. So beyond CD19, if you want to bring up some of the other B-cell malignancies like CLL to similar results as ALL, is moving on to another B-cell target likely to work, or are there other limitations? What are thoughts about sort of next targets just within B-cell malignancies?
I mean, they're looking at CD22 is one that for patients that have relapsed with CD19 negative ALL, so that's probably not a bad idea. I think in CLL, they're looking at ROR1, several groups are, as a target, which may be more exquisite to CLL and protect normal B cells. I don't think that CD19 on the CLL cells is the problem of why we don't get the same results that we get with CLL.
Right.
And I think that another issue with CLL is these patients can present in the relapse setting with kilograms of tumor, and that may simply overwhelm. I mean, there's another question that's lingering here, is what's the right amount of disease to target? You can certainly see that at the high-end spectrum of disease that these T cells can simply not combat these large, bulky tumors, and perhaps treating, as we have done, with much more success, it's true, CLL with upfront chemotherapy, and those patients that have residual disease we give the CAR T cells to because it's a manageable amount of disease, is probably not a bad approach, rather than giving patients with, again, literally kilograms of disease these CAR T cells. I don't know if finding a different target on CLL is going to change those fundamental issues.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, actually, the experiment in changing the target will give you some insight into your three possibilities, because if it's a defect in the patient's T cells, then changing the receptor specificity should not change the situation. And if the tumor cell is inherently highly suited to turning off a T-cell response, then regardless of what the target antigen that you have for the specificity of the CAR, you're going to end up with the same situation. So a second CAR specificity will give you further insight into why the CD19 CAR T isn't working, perhaps.
Derek?
Yeah, so target is one thing I agree with what's been said about the target. Process improvements could also be different. Could also change the outcomes for certain disease types. So this goes back to what we were talking about earlier about is it one process for every indication or different processes? For example, is there a better way? Can you change the process in manufacturing in a way that improves the phenotype of T cells? There's various methods to do that. So that's probably an easier way to get there than changing the target and starting because it's a whole new pathway. So that I think a lot of groups are looking at that.
Okay. Any questions from the audience? Take a little pause if anybody has anything to ask. No? Here's a question over here.
I've heard anecdotal reports that the CD19 CAR actually has been tested, CAR cells have been tested in sort of unexpected diseases and shown efficacy. Multiple myeloma is the one that comes to mind. I wonder if traditionally in oncology drug development, we take every tool we have and we try it every place else we can possibly think of, and I realize that the biology of CD19 drives us to think in a different way, but I wonder if one of the panelists might comment on testing these reagents in different settings than one might have normally predicted.
Leave that up to you. I mean, it's
sure. Yeah. So there is a multiple myeloma trial that's being run at Penn. It's exploratory. I can't reveal what's much behind that, but there is some rationale. Multiple myeloma. CD19 is expressed on the clonotypic B cells that give rise to multiple myeloma. It's not necessarily present on the multiple myeloma itself. So the investigators at Penn have thought of this, again, as a way perhaps to move toward consolidation therapy, after along lines of what I was saying earlier. So, yeah, it doesn't exactly make sense if you look at it from the outside, but there was some rationale behind that. I expect those results will be presented sometime soon. So. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, thanks, Louise. That kind of gives us a little segue into our next topic. So outside of B-cell malignancies, applying to other heme malignancies or solid tumors, what sort of things are being done there as far as new targets and whatnot to make it more broadly applicable?
Okay.
Well, I think I tried to outline in the slide I showed the variety of targets that are amenable for T-cell receptor-based therapies. And the clinical studies that are ongoing that have shown good clinical efficacy in sarcomas, in melanoma, have been the cancer testis antigen, New York ESO1 is one example that comes forward with no toxicity or very low toxicity. The differentiation antigens, there were quite some remarkable clinical responses in patients, but associated with really high toxicities that were reversible, but I think that has moved the field to look for more discriminatory target molecules. A lot of, I don't know whether I'll say hype, but a lot of attention is being paid to the possibility of neoepitopes that you could use next generation sequencing of a patient's tumor, identify the potential mutations, because in some tumors that's going to be very many. How do you sort which of those you should use as a potential target molecule? Therefore, figure out which of those are driver mutations that might be so essential to the function of the tumor cell that you would be able to, it would be expressed in all of the daughter cells of the tumor. The difficulty that one has with that is those for a T cell receptor specificity, and that's the only thing you can use for an intracellular mutated protein, is those epitopes have to fit to one of the MHC molecules of the patient. And because you'll only get the presentation on the tumor cell if out of that mutated protein you get a processing and presentation step that clips that a peptide that's 8 to 10 amino acids in length, and that's bound by one of the patient's own MHC molecules and comes to the surface of the tumor cell. And that is a major hurdle to determine whether that process is going to work. And you may be searching for a very small needle in a haystack to find among the multiple mutations, which you would think are perfect target molecules, to find those which have the right binding characteristics for an MHC molecule of the patient to be able to bind that and put it on the tumor cell surface. So I think there's a lot of work in that. There's a small company in Germany, Immatics, which has been looking really at the mutated immunome, so the peptides in a tumor, and they have even tried to elute potential mutated proteins off the surface of MHC molecules as a way to overcome that problem. If you have sequence information, that has not been an absolutely successful solution to that problem, perhaps because so few molecules. One predicts that an effective killer cell can see two MHC peptide complexes on the surface of a cell. It may be just below all possible level of detection to use such a tool to find which of those mutated epitopes. So I think there's going to be a real long development before one can go to the patient individualized neo-mutated epitope specific T cell receptor therapy.
I agree. I mean, WT1, for example, is a very attractive target. They are developing CARs to WT1 now as well. They're TCR-like CARs. I think that the myeloid, I mean, I have my colleagues on the leukemia service keep asking when we're going to start a trial for AML. And that's kind of the issue. The myeloid tumor cells don't offer a CD19 equivalent. And targeting any of these AML targets, like CD33, for example, is wrought with potential toxicity and an inability to recover if the T cells persist. And so I think that looking into that and looking maybe at the WT1 as a target, PRAME I think is also a potential target. Those are perhaps better targets for non-B cell malignancies.
Mm-hmm. But in the format of a T cell receptor based.
They can now generate with these phage display libraries. You can that are all for human scFvs. You can sort for and find scFvs or single fragment length antibodies that recognize peptide in the context of particular HLA. So there is a possibility that you could develop CARs as well that have TCR like function. But yes, the answer is. One or both approaches would be a way of targeting these internal peptides and target antigens that are not conveniently surface exposed.
Mm-hmm. Tom, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, so we've obviously, picked and named a few antigen targets that we're interested in pursuing. We're also very interested in novel antigens. And, you know, we have the benefit of a platform technology that's essentially platform agnostic. We could use it in a CAR and a TCR, not just the safety switch, but the activation switch, which I haven't really said very much about. So we like the targets we picked, PRAME. CD19 is, still, we think, interesting. There was some discussion around, the fact that, ALL, you got very high response rates. Perhaps less impressive in other B-cell malignancies, and the potential that patients will be excluded from treatment based on the volume of disease, et cetera. So we think CD19 is still an interesting opportunity for a product that has safety built into it. But really our focus as a company has been much more on the underlying technology, the ability to control the cell. And again, I talked at the outset about the fact that there's a liability associated with the fact that you have a cell that's proliferating. There's also an opportunity in the fact that you have a cell. You have something that you can potentially control, not in a passive way, but in an active way, so that you can actually guide the cell, if you understand enough about the biology, to a point at which it's having a consistent effect. And so antigen selection aside, we're very much focused on how do you activate the T cell appropriately so that it does persist long enough to encounter antigen and to get a sufficient stimulus to start to proliferate.
Okay, a couple of extra lines only. So at Novartis, there are trials ongoing in mesothelin as well as EGFRv3. And there's a pipeline coming after that. I think all the targets that have been discussed are valid, and you'll see them coming up in the next couple of years from various institutions.
I guess I would just comment. I mean, there's quite a lot of secrecy around targets. It's kind of interesting. Most of the companies in this space are reluctant to say what they're going after. I guess you don't want to tip your hand.
I'm looking at my head of BND right here, so I'm not sure that.
I mean, obviously, as products move into the clinic, that will change.
There are quite extensive surface proteomic databases. There's quite a bit of information available out there, which can pinpoint you to potential molecules. I don't think it's rocket science to figure out and put together. There have been consensus lists from the NCI for T-cell receptor targets, which were derived from kind of pooling the attitudes of the immunologists in the U.S. on what would be suitable targets for T-cell receptor specificities, or I guess it wasn't even T-cell receptor specificities, what would be good vaccine targets. Of course, if an antigen has been identified as a good vaccine target, then its purpose is to activate T-cells. So that same list of antigens you would find also to be represented as a list of potential T-cell receptor targets.
So the previous panel focused on checkpoint inhibitors and other non-cell-based approaches. So where do all these different cellular approaches fit in, or exploring combinations even with these other, antibody and small molecule approaches?
I mean, the checkpoint inhibitors are a great example, and I'll put a plug in here for my mentor, Michelle Sadelain. We wrote a P01 grant probably about 10 years ago suggesting to combine ipilimumab with CAR T cells, and it was roundly rejected by the committee. So Michelle loves telling that story to anyone who will listen. But it's absolutely low-hanging fruit. I mean, one of the things that checkpoint inhibition is dependent on is an underlying endogenous anti-tumor response. With CAR T cells, we can provide that response, and the antibody can then provide, fighter escort for the bombers to reach their site. I think there is actually a Baylor one trial that proposes combination with ipilimumab and CAR T cells, and I would be hard pressed to imagine that several of us sitting here at this table are not contemplating the idea of combining PD-1 or PD-L1 blockade with CAR T cells as well.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Sure. It's the next step. Sure.
Exactly, and it's a natural for T-cell receptors as well. We know that TILs from melanoma patients, we heard this morning that the clonality of the T-cell response is predictive of response to checkpoint inhibitors. If you don't have those T-cells up front, then give them to the patient right along with the checkpoint inhibitors. It's a natural.
Yeah, so I doubt there's anyone that's not thinking about it. We're actually evaluating a checkpoint inhibitor combination trial with our vaccine product first. Of course, combining a CAR T-cell with a checkpoint inhibitor again may raise some safety issues. I don't want to keep banging that drum. But there are two practical questions. There's a practical question about how do you do it. Do you combine a CAR T-cell with a checkpoint inhibitor, or do you engineer the CAR T-cell to get around the checkpoint? And I think both approaches are being considered by different groups. Gene editing, of course, to edit out the appropriate pathways in the CAR T-cell. The advantage of a combination, of course, is that you're not locked in from the outset into a particular a pathway. So PD-1 is the right one, then you use a PD-1 inhibitor, PD-L1, CTLA-4, et cetera.
This could also be another way to increase the efficacy in non-ALL heme malignancies, so to be explored.
CLL?
Well, yeah, I mean, CLL is also, you know, an attractive area. I think that what we've learned, and as we add things to the T cells, one of the things is that the checkpoint inhibitor story kind of revealed to me. If you had asked me 17 years ago whether I think patients develop an immune response to cancer, I would have said no, which explains why I was busy trying to generate that immune response myself. What is very clear with the checkpoint data is that there is, in fact, a potentially robust anti-tumor, endogenous anti-tumor effect, and one wonders what ultimately the role of the CAR T-cell will be. Right now, it's being utilized as the weapon against the cancer. Alternatively, I can easily envision in the future that these CAR T-cells, that their persistence and presence may be only shortly necessary, that it's the ignition that ultimately drives the patient's own immune system, which, again, is not targeted perhaps to a single antigen that the tumor can escape from, but multiple antigens. And so rather than seeing this as I'm dying on analogies here, but rather than seeing that it's the actual soldier, it's simply the spark that sets off an already pre-existing explosion that the immune system is capable of. It just needs to be sparked in the right direction, and so that in turn can overcome a lot of the issues with safety if these cells are in fact just necessary to be there for a short period of time. And the data that we're generating in our lab in the mouse model seems to suggest that long-term persistence of these CAR T cells may not actually at all be necessary. And there's others that have published similar data. Charles Sentman from Dartmouth, for example, says that you don't need them there for a very long time.
Any more questions? Anybody? Okay. All right. So we talk a lot about different features, different ways that you're addressing potential safety issues, ways to increase efficacy, expanding to new antigens and going on to new tumor types. I guess my question is that how do we get to the sort of optimized or ultimate CAR T cell approach? Given the fact that now different pieces are owned by different companies and academic institutions and stuff, I mean, does that pose any barriers to get to the next step in the progress?
I guess an observation, and again, it's a somewhat unique space in that it has been around for a long time and people just didn't know it. I would imagine that if Rene had gone to his licensing office 15 years ago, said, I've got a great new invention here, can we file a patent? Yeah. They might have filed a provisional in the U.S., probably wouldn't have taken it that much further because there would have been no one there to pay for it. So
that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. So in a way, the science is quite mature, but there's not a lot of IP out there. So it could be, there could have been a lot more obstacles to navigate around than there actually are. I don't know if you have the same.
Well, I mean, the IP is scattered across so many parts of the process, and this you can almost call it a process, not a therapy. It's more than a drug, more than a therapy. It's more than a product. And I think I'm confident that through collaboration, we're gonna be able to figure out a path forward, at least to get the launch done for patients. So mm-hmm. I'm not. Yes, it's a roadblock, but is it going to stop this sort of therapy with these response rates from getting out? I don't think so.
Okay. I guess the other question is, do you try to bite off everything at once, or do you do things one step at a time?
Right.
Again, we see the next challenge in solid tumors as being to get the cells to proliferate. And so that's what we're focused on. If we can do that, then maybe we think about the next thing. Clearly, there's a lot of interest in off-the-shelf approaches. I thought the opening session this morning was fascinating. You throw into that mix, you know, obviously there's a cost of goods associated with cell therapy that creates somewhat unique challenges there. Obviously, you've got to be able to sell your product for significantly more than it costs you to make. So clearly, a real driver there for moving towards something that's off the shelf. We're not convinced that that's quite ready for prime time just yet, but hopefully it's coming. You know, we're working on it, I'm sure. Novartis is working on it. Renee, are you guys working on the
off the shelf?
Off the shelf.
I'm sure some Juno is not in my lab. I actually think just on that line. I mean, there's a lot of hoopla about off the shelf, and the amount of time that the cells need to be in culture to achieve that. I think that there are multiple obstacles to it, more than just turning off a TCR or turning off an HLA, and quite honestly, I think that if this therapy remains as efficacious as it is, I think that industry will find a way to make this very manageable by collecting cells, modifying cells, and sending them back to the patient. I'm not sold at all on this need for off-the-shelf. I mean, it sounds good, and it sounds fancy and sexy, but I think that there are multiple biologic reasons why that are going to inhibit that from being a reality. As of now, from what we understand. And again, you know, this is just my opinion, and it's true. It would be great if it was off the shelf, if you could send the cells to CVS and you could pick them up, and all of that would be wonderful. I just think that the complexity of what we're talking about here and our understanding of T-cell biology and of tumor biology don't allow us to make that jump forward. And I applaud anyone that does so, because the cost would obviously go down, the availability will go up, and the amount of patients that can be treated will go up. But I have some reservations about whether that's feasible.
Mm-hmm. I think, again, it's a situation where the availability of more capital and resources is potentially transformational. Again, to this point, most of the clinical data has been in the academic setting, where you manufacture the product in the same center, you don't worry about logistics, et cetera. Companies now are starting to take on the challenge of, okay, how do you actually make a product that you can reliably, consistently ship, freeze, ship to the site, administer automation. You know, there's a lot of opportunity for automation in the process of making these products. So I would agree with Rainier that really the resources and kind of innovation has not yet been fully applied to address the issue of complexity, cost of goods, logistics, et cetera. And we think that it's potentially a manageable challenge.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think my skepticism shouldn't stop us from moving forward. My experience with cells that have been in culture too long is that those cells, when they're infused, and the NCI can speak to this, I mean, if you go to 10 to the 12th T cells, those cells are not worth the tissue culture fluid they're in. And so I just wonder how well we can keep those cells alive and proliferating so they can be an off-the-shelf product. But if it gets done, it's a big step forward in our technology.
Just a word about the cost, since we're talking about costs. In this field, we're finally realizing that the need for an integrated dialogue that includes thinking about reimbursement right from the beginning is essential. Otherwise, this is not just about getting a drug to market. It's getting it back to the patient, which is not the same thing at all. So at least for the auto cars, that's a very important dialogue to have, and we're starting to have it with regulators as well as reimbursement authorities around the world.
Okay. Well, on that note, I think we're just about done, unless the panelists had any, you know, last thoughts or anything else you want to say. Okay, well, thank you, everybody. It's a really interesting panel. Before the next panel.